Session number 12367, John West, part one.
Could we start, please, by your telling me where you were born?
I was born in Birmingham.
And what your father did for a living?
He worked for a brewery in the transport department.
Did you go to school in Birmingham?
Yes.
How did you come to be in the Palestine Police?
We were in Birmingham during the war, and I reached call-up age in 1946. That was 18. And by that time, the war was over, and there wasn't very much interesting going on. And you had various options at that time. The army and the navy didn't need you, but you could become a Bevin boy and go down the mines, or you could, I think there were positions in as stewards in the Royal, in the Merchant Navy. And then suddenly the this brilliant advertising campaign of pictures of a chap like Lawrence of Arabia sitting on a camel in the sunshine joined the Palestine police force and all found. £20 a month and all found, I think, was the catch. And that seemed rather more interesting. They'd just blown up the King David Hotel. So I thought that was the preferable alternative, and I chose to go to the Palestine police force.
The terrorism in Palestine didn't put you off?
It was rather an attraction.
In what sense?
One had grown up during the war when there was a lot happening, and one was used to it, and suddenly the theatre of operations. One had really wanted to go and fly an aeroplane or do something like that, and the theatre of operations moved suddenly to Palestine, and it seemed the place to be, to get a bit of action. Silly sort of things you think of when you're 18.
Was it difficult for you to get in?
No. I filled in a form and went to London for a medical and was on the way 2 weeks later.
What did the journey consist of?
Well, it was an interesting trip. We met up at the Crown Agents for the Colonies at 4 Millbank, and we were given kit bags with some uniforms and hats and boots without any training, and we were formed up into a squad of about 40, taken by bus to Victoria, by train to Dover, across on a ferry to Dunkirk, and from Dunkirk by train through to the south of France. It was called the Medlock route in those days, and we had 3 days in a transit camp at Yerres, and then we sailed on a troop ship from Marseille to Port Said, which took 3 days or so. And then by train from Port Said to Alcantara, where we crossed the canal, and then by another train across the Sinai to up to Haifa, and finally ended up in trucks going to the police depot at Jenin, where we began our formal training.
What impression did the Palestine police make on you when you got there?
I enjoyed the country, and I enjoyed the sounds and the smells and the colour and the excitement, and I enjoyed the training, come to that. As one grew into it and learned more about what was happening around you, I think a good deal of disillusionment came into it. The whole business of, and looking back on it now, even more so, the whole business of trying to maintain law and order in a country where we weren't wanted was really very trying. And you got to the point where you wondered whether it was all worthwhile. We seemed to have, in fact we did, we promised the same territory to both communities, both Arab and Jew, beginning in about 1915 and gradually going on, appeasing one side than the other, never honestly facing up to the issues. And I think perhaps that was one of the more shameful bits of British colonial history. Not a thing I'm ashamed of, British colonial history, but that bit I'm not particularly proud of. And really it was only Ernest Bevin who faced up to the issue in 1947 and and convinced the British government that we should withdraw and leave the United Nations to get on with it. A whole of the mess and everything that's happened since stems very largely from I think, the British indecision. I don't think it was wickedness, I think it was stupidness, but I get no pleasure out of remembering the background to that. I enjoyed the country and the people and much of it, and wanted always to be a policeman after that, but I didn't think we were fighting a good fight, which is very different from the impression one formed as soon as one got to Malaya.
How did the fact that the population didn't want you there manifest itself to you personally?
I was much of my time in a Jewish station in Hadar Carmel in Haifa.
In where?
Hadar HaCarmel. It's halfway up the Mount Carmel in Haifa. It's the Jewish main centre. It was quite clear that the Jewish community, by and large, regarded you as the occupying power and regarded you with great suspicion. And, of course, from time to time, one was shot at on a bad day. So, and one was forever protecting oneself and one's colleagues from bombing and ambushes and things. So there was no doubt at all we were unwelcome there. The Arabs, one was less, they weren't as well organized, one was less conscious of it. Neither community for quite a long time ever thought we would leave, particularly the Arabs. And the Arabs used to say, my Arab friends would say, when you go, of course, we shall have a holy war, a jihad, and the Arabs from all the way from Indonesia through to the Atlantic will rise and cut the throats of the Yahudi. Fascinating for me to read all that sort of stuff, that junk that they were talking during the time of the Gulf War this time. You know, we're going to have a jihad and the Muslims throughout the world will rise, and it was always a myth, and I think it always will be. They never get themselves well enough organized to actually pull it off. They're so busy actually scrapping with one another, the poor old Arabs.
Just to divert from that a minute to the training that you had, what did you think of the training that you received personally at Jenin?
It was weapons and minor tactics, I suppose, and there was some very good law. One enjoyed the law sessions, where one learned a good deal about the history and the attitudes and habits of the people. I thought that the academic side of it was very good.
But did the training really prepare you for the job that you had to do, do you think?
Yes, I think it did. One was, as a constable in Hadar HaCarmel, one spent one's days patrolling, usually with an Arab and a Jewish constable, concentrating rather on law and order in the sense of clearing up the streets of beggars and minor misdemeanors, traffic, untangling traffic jams, occasionally dealing with the odd fracas, but one was quietly patrolling, usually in threes, and we were dealing usually with Arab criminals in Jewish areas.
What type of criminals?
Oh, petty theft, bag snatching, thefts from cars, you know, that sort of thing. There was nothing very serious. We didn't have organized gangsterism, except at the political level.
Coming back to the political issue, you were saying about the British policy towards the area. We had a program on television recently made by an Arab lady, I think, who claimed that the Jews and the Arabs would have got on well together if it wasn't for the British. Do you think there's any truth in that from what you saw personally?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Quite a number of them did actually get on quite well. But I think it would have been like that. I think everybody would have got away with it if it hadn't been for Adolf Hitler and 1933 and the beginnings of the Holocaust. I think that gave a poignancy and it gave a cogency to Zionism and to the need for a refuge for the Jews that without him may never have happened. I think I don't think it would have become the issue it is now. It would have been a shrine, a sort of Jewish Stratford-on-Avon, a very prosperous and happy place, I should have thought, with the Jews and Arabs cohabiting. I think it wasn't so much us, it was Adolf Hitler, really, that created the real hatred began when Britain began to allow in, on humanitarian grounds, many thousands of Jews, and the Arabs began to take exception to it. And the Arab uprising of 1936 was the direct outcome of that.
Would you have explicit discussions with either Jews or Arabs about the political issue and the British presence there?
Well, yes, one did. One made several friends. And the main thing, I think, was a sort of general. There was a belief in perfidious Albion that Britain may appear not to be making a mess of things, when in fact the Arabs say they're sharp, they've got brains, and they think round three corners, and you think they're making a mistake, but in 5 years' time you'll see how clever it was. They all seemed to believe that we had this great power of thinking through and round corners and getting it right in the long term. Having learned history about the white man spreading wisdom under the banyan tree throughout the colonial empire, I thought perhaps they were right. The disillusionment came about halfway through when you realised that we, in fact, were not all that bright and that we'd made a mess of it.
How did you make these personal friends?
One worked with them. One shared a station with Jews and Arabs and worked out on patrol with them and occasionally socialised and had a drink with them and went to their homes. There were some very nice people, some very good friends.
Did you ever come across any Jews or Arabs who actually wanted Britain to stay?
Oh yes, there were a number who thought that something was going to be necessary to keep them from getting at one another's throats. But I think these were odd individuals who were concerned and rather committed to us, with careers with us, so I'm not so sure that they were truly representative.
Are there any incidents that happened to you regarding the security situation that you can describe in detail?
Well, there are a number, I suppose, yes. Towards the end, I was in Jerusalem at Mustashfa Billet, and a convoy of police vehicles was driven into Jerusalem, the centre of Jerusalem, into Ben Yehuda Street. It was in February 1948, I think it was, not long before the end. And they alleged to be British policemen got out of the trucks, two trucks and a Land Rover or something like that, and an armoured, and drove away and left these trucks, which then exploded and killed a great many people in Ben Yehuda Street. And of course we were stuck out at the edge of Jerusalem, surrounded by Jewish areas all round, and we knew the balloon was going up for us. The Irgun and people were moving in round us, and they were going to take us apart in our little billet. And they did. It started about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but by that time we had an armoured column, and we literally had to fight our way out and get up to the depot at Jenin and abandon that billet. It was too late in the day to do anything to save it. But I remember I was driving a truck at that time, and I was dashing out throughout that day collecting odd British policemen, some of whom were with girlfriends and some were with some were out on other duties. There was one little group that we nearly forgot that were on duty at the top of a water tower, which we recovered quite late in the afternoon. Well, most of us got away with that.
Who was the explosion directed against?
It was directed against the Jewish community. It was an Arab plot. And I think one of the regrettable things that perhaps you know about is that on both sides then were busy recruiting mercenaries from the British forces, both the police and the army. There were Britons working for both sides at that late stage, preparing for the war that was to come. And I don't think there's any doubt there were at least two British policemen in British police uniform who had defected to the Arabs. Usually women were behind it, I must say. There was either an Arab girl or a Jewish girl had got at them and convinced them of the right of their cause. I think almost certainly there were Britons involved, and of course I think it was almost inevitable that the anger would turn on us, those who in fact had nothing to do with it. It wasn't a British plot at all. It was an Arab act of terrorism, planned for them by a couple of Britons, I think, and it blew up a huge chunk of Ben Yehuda Street. On the other side of the coin, later on, just before we came out, the view was taken, I think it was Huey Stockwell was the general in charge, that we wouldn't interfere when Arab and Jew began to fight. And I remember a Jewish convoy going up to relieve the Hadassah hospital outside Jerusalem, going through the Sheikh Jarrah quarter. They had about 4 armoured buses loaded with medical workers and Haganah. And that was ambushed by an Arab group. And I went through it. I was driving what they called a heavy armoured car, and I was driving backwards and forwards through this battle all day, moving people in and out from our depot into the centre of town. I was a sort of bus. And I watched this battle brew up all day, and it ended up with all of the, I suppose, about 35 young Jews being brewed up in their buses. It was all very sad. And we actually did nothing. Neither the army or the police did nothing to interfere with that. Which wasn't, I didn't think, which I thought was very sad. But the corollary of that came a few days later when the Irgun took a party into a village near Jerusalem called Deir Yassin and murdered mercilessly a couple of hundred Arabs, mostly who were old men, women and children. I think they had rightly identified where the terrorist group had come from, but they hadn't gone back there, but they began their eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth campaign with utter savagery.
Did you come at all close to that Deir Yassin incident?
I had friends who were in the escort party. I think it was a Red Cross man, Paul Renault or somebody like that, went in to look at it, and there were police and military escorts, and I knew a couple of the fellows who were in it. And I didn't actually see it.
You didn't know any of those British policemen who were seduced from their duty to take sides?
I knew one who I met later, some years later. He came out, got fed up with it all, and of course, I don't think anyone took action against him. I don't know whether he actually took part in any terrorist acts. I know he defected to the Arab side. And I met him later, and he much regretted it and thought it was all a dreadful mistake.
Did he say how it had all come about?
It was a love affair. And he got very fond of this girl and became a Muslim and joined them. But that all that broke up with general disillusionment with his lot.
What did you think of the role of the army in Palestine from the point of view of being a policeman?
Oh, it was very clear cut. We didn't really overlap too much in the sort of actions we took. And I think, by and large, they did very well. I worked with the parachute regiment in Haifa, and and one or two other armoured, I think the 17th, one of the Lancer regiments. But they were largely, in our role, they were protecting us on large military movements. We did the small stuff around the towns, and we called them in when something heavy was to be done, which was the right way, and I think it worked quite well. I thought the military tactics in Haifa, when Haifa was chosen to be the evacuation port, where all the British were going to go home through, and I don't think there was any doubt. The Arabs all believed, and those of us who were there also believed, that there was complete collusion between the British command and the Jews to give the Jews complete and total control of Haifa. I can't prove it, but there was a suspicion of a deal that if we gave one side or the other complete and total control, our withdrawal would be completely unimpeded, and in fact it was completely unimpeded. It could have been a sort of Vietnam scale withdrawal, but it wasn't. It was all very orderly and leisurely. But the Jews had been given Haifa on a plate in order to make that happen.
Was there much difference between the situations in Haifa and in Jerusalem?
No, not really. No, I don't really think there were. The attitudes of both sides were much the same. One at first thought the Jews in the Arabs in Haifa would put up a better fight than they did, but they didn't have the stiffening of and support of people like the Arab Legion, and of course the British Army stopped the Arab Legion moving down into Haifa when that battle for Haifa began. They were actually stopped, there were roadblocks thrown up, and no reinforcements were allowed into the Arab forces at all. Whereas in Haifa, they were better able to look after themselves and defended the old city.
In Jerusalem?
In Jerusalem, yes.
Did you, in your time there, have anything to do with stopping illegal immigration?
Oh, yes. We used to take turns to go down to the port and offload migrants coming in from, one was the Exodus 1947, an old banana boat, and taking them across the wharf and putting them on a troop ship, the Empire Battle Axe, I think it was, to be sent across to Cyprus to be interned. We all took a hand at that. Quite a lot of us took a hand at that. But of course, these were always times of great pressure. We were living in Hadar HaCarmel, the Jewish area, our billet was in the middle of it. And we always used to stay at home. We would never move out other than on specifically planned official duties. We wouldn't go to the cinema or anything like that. We used to stay in our little station on alert and wait for the shooting, because somebody else would come up, some soldiers or some oil men, both happened in my day, would come up and go to dinner at Maxime's restaurant and get shot. There was always an incident when we had one of these when we had one of these illegal immigrant ships come in.
What was the demeanour of the illegal immigrants?
Oh, hostile beyond belief. You got pelted with everything, cans of bully beef, anything to protect. You really had to drag them off and across and put them onto the other ship. Oh, they were, you know, a lot of them were tattooed. They were genuine refugees from the camps of Europe. And they were in no mood to be reasonable, quite understandable.
What were your feelings on leaving Palestine?
It's difficult to describe. Rather disappointment, that I think relief at the end that we were making a clean break and getting out, but a sad feeling that we'd left a nasty taste in everybody's mouth, including our own.